Patibhotitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritam Purana Mununa Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamani Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadveshini. Verse 16. Anapeksha Suchir Dakshaha. Anapeksha Suchir Dakshaha. Udasino Gita Vitaha. Udasino Gita Vitaha. Sarvaram Bhaparityagi. Sarvaram Bhaparityagi. Yo mad bhakta same priyaha. Yo mad bhakta same priyaha. Anapekshaha shuchihi dakshaha udasinaha gata vyattaha sarva arambha parityagi yaha mad bhaktaha same priyaha. There's several of these that are ending with this. Madhvakta has some nature, huh? 1, 2, 3, 4. These are just a lot of different descriptive adjectives for the jnani, for the glorious knowledge. Anapekshaha. Apekshaha means to be hoped for, be dependent upon something. Anapeksha means non-dependence, being independent. Again, in a sense, each one of these, this is why the last part of this, the whole chapter is very valuable. The last part, which is descriptive of the jnani, of the one who has jnana nishtha, is so important because these qualities are natural for one who has self-knowledge, because the reason for dependence has been removed. You know, it's not just that it's not just a practice of, oh, what not, don't let me be dependent on anything. The reason for the feeling of dependence is removed. And so sometimes we'll say, and Swamiji actually says this in one of these sections here. Which one was he talking about? I don't remember which one, but it's generally true for all of them. What is absolutely natural for jnana, one who has knowledge, can be used or viewed as a sadhana for one who doesn't have knowledge, for a mamukshu, becomes a sadhana. But even then, understanding what that means for it to be a sadhana is this. Of all of these values that we've been going through, when they're absolutely natural for jnani, because the knowledge removes the cause for the opposite behavior. For instance, it removes the cause for dependence, or it removes the cause for having a reactive mind. All of these, the actual cause is removed. But for a mumukshu, as we start gaining this clarity, the understanding is there. The knowledge is appreciated, but not integrated. And as we first start listening, as we do the continue doing the shravana, you understand it, you see it, it makes sense, but on an emotional level, you know, it hasn't been integrated. The reality of this knowledge is owned by the buddhi, but not yet by the manas, by our emotional life. And so it's over time that this knowledge begins to, by the emotional life, starts to, and all of the complexes and all of their habitual ways of reaction, ways of responding, start to actually drop off in the light of our knowledge. another way of understanding why this is so, I think, and that is this. But as you, when you first gain knowledge and are gaining clarity, the mind or the manas, or the normal way of reacting, or the normal way of being in the world, which is really as somebody who is subject to birth and death and whose ananda is external. That's what we come with. That's what we bring to this knowledge. Here I am as an individual who's subject to birth and death, heaven and hell, and all of these type of things. And I'm seeking, just naturally, those things in life that make me happy, that will make me a whole, complete being. That's what we bring to the table. Now the thing is, what makes you a mumukshu is you're starting to really recognize on a very deep level, not on a pretend level, on a level that makes you seek knowledge, that actually, even though this is your experience, that you're subject to birth and death, and that your ananda is out here, this formula doesn't really work. To think that I can actually make myself whole and complete by satisfying my desires, I start to realize on a very real level that that isn't so. That's one of the things that makes me a mumukshu. Also, the idea of birth and death, or even death to my being, is not something that we can really accept. You can accept death because we all know that the body dies. You know that the body dies. But that you die is another thing. The problem with it is that we can never have even the slightest semblance of any experience like that. There is no such thing as a death experience. Even it's interesting to look at, even going through waking and dream and deep sleep, you think that there would be a death experience of some sort, right? Because you're going into a totally different world of experience. You're leaving everything behind in the waking state to go into the dream. Again, you leave everything behind from the dream state into the deep sleep state. But for you, there's what we call an anuvritti. There is no change in being. Now that's true no matter what your experience is, even in this loka, in this realm of reality. There's no change in your experience of being. There's change in what you're experiencing. There's change in your happiness and sadness. There's change in that. But there is no change in you. You are the always there as the one who's experiencing all these things. Even though you totally identify with it, your presence is a constant, And so, there's many things about, well, let's put it this way. Everything that you take to be true, which isn't true, and everything that you take to be true, which isn't true, doesn't ring true with your nature. That's why, in fact, when somebody who's a mumukshu, who's actually has some space to think about these things, starts hearing Vedanta, or hears the Upanishad unfolded, is hearing something which is true on an emotional level. It's as though you've always heard it. You've heard it, you've known all of this, but nobody's ever said it. That's often that one way this experience is, you've always known this, and now finally it's being said. But actually, it's not that you've known it. You've known it in the sense that this is the way it is. This is reality. And so when it's heard, it resonates very, very deeply as though you've always known it, because it is the truth of who you are. And so when this, the truth of who you are is recognized, your buddhi owns it up. The buddhi owns it up and makes all connections and more connections, which then gives the buddhi the strength or the wisdom or the knowledge which is natural to it to be able to hold the manas, all of the emotional reactions that were generated because of relating to the world, relating to your life and experience in a way that it isn't. It's like beating your head against the wall. Nothing really works. That's why everything, in fact, all the experiences, really a dukkha yoni. dukkha itself brings more dukkha, and sukha, of course, brings dukkha also, because there is no constancy in your experience. And so the whole life is really trying to handle life in such a way that is in the end not going to work. That's what we're doing. We're handling life in the best, even the first part of the Vedas is telling you how to handle this mirage in the best possible way to get the most relative sukha. And basically it just boils down to dharma, you know, because dharma itself gives us the most long-lasting effects in terms of the pala, the result of dharma. Because dharma is something that is much more under our control than anything in this physical world, our value system. But the value system has to be backed by knowledge in order for it to work also. You know, so, but the whole first part of the Vedas is on dharma. The second part of the Vedas is on moksha. Dharma means what behavior, how to be in this world in a way that can give me relative shanti. Second part is how to have shanti, how to be a whole, complete being, not just relatively. Okay? So now here, these values, as we go through one by one, they're just describing you what is natural to your buddhi, what's natural to the manas, what's natural to your being, that behavior. For the mumukshu, those behaviors of the mind are not natural yet. Once one person gets, they're not natural because the mind is still governed by ajnanam. And so, you see that? When you first come to the knowledge, your mind is governed by ignorance. Your raga dvesha, your desires, your wants, what you need from the world, it's governed by raga dvesha, you know, by the desire template. Let me have this so that I can be whole. And that desire, and let me not have this so that I can be whole and complete. That desire template is insidious. It's pervasive. It goes not only to your relationship with the external world, it goes to your relationship with your physical body, your physical appearance, with the nature of your mind, how smart it is or how stupid it is, you know, with the way that you think, the skills that you have, you know, your emotional life. Everything is festering raga dvesha, you know, wanting to change this and needing to change that and needing to change this and that goes on and on. And so once you get knowledge, as you get knowledge, this all starts slowly loosening up. But the thing is, there's an emotional lag time to this reactive life that we've had based upon ignorance, based upon ajnana. There's an emotional lag time. And so what that means is that your knowledge and your clarity isn't initially strong enough to compete with your emotional life. I want this with it, with your desire template. Right? And so then what happens, do you understand what I'm saying? Am I clear so far? Your emotional life, your desire, the desire template is still very strong. You know, I really do need this, you know. The mind is so clever, it'll even make up things like this. I know that I don't in truth really need this to be happy, but I need it. I do that, you know. So we have all overlays of all of this kind of stuff. Okay, so there's this type of lag time or conflict between what we know to be true and our behavior. And so now, this is when Swamiji brings in this phrase, you know, fake it till you make it. But this phrase, in a way, people will react against this phrase, fake it till you make it. Like, I don't want to fake it. I don't want to fake it. I don't think that's being honest. This fake it till you make it, you know, because I've heard these kind of, but Swamiji, you know, that's not being honest. I should be honest in how I feel. You know, and all of that.
Authentic.
I'm not being authentic. I'm not being honest like that. So we have to understand what he means, and you know, when you say fake it till we make it, because it's all totally relevant to this, what we're talking about here. How what is absolutely natural to a jnani is a sadhana to a mumukshu. And it's because of this. As you gain knowledge, you do have a clarity, your buddhi, your intellect, your mind, it has a clarity which is initially not as strong as your impulses around your so-called desires. You know, it's even though I know that I don't really need this, but I do need it. That kind of a conflict, which causes, whenever you have any type of a desire in terms of what you need for your well-being, that desire brings up all kinds of insecurities and emotions. Like, I really need this, and you are not allowing me to have it. That brings up a whole slew of reactions. Or, I really need this, and look at what Bhagavan is doing. He has favorites. Yeah, it's endless. I mean, it's endless what our mind can do. And so now the thing is, how to handle our behavior, even internally and externally. So when he says, fake it till you make it, another way of saying that is, what are your values? What is your value structure for your buddhi? You know, what do you know in terms of, what is your knowledge in reference to this desire? If you could even say like this, if I were living out my knowledge, if I were living out what I know, how would I respond in this situation? How would I respond? And then you do that. You don't feel that way. You don't feel that way, but you act that way. Because you're acting from your knowledge, not from your emotions. You see what I mean? And so you're faking it from what standpoint? It's like saying, people will think, my emotional response is what is real. You know, and if I'm not acting off of my emotional response, I'm not being authentic. And I say, that isn't true at all. It's all that means is you're not acting out of your emotional response. You're acting from your buddhi, and you're making a choice, even though your emotional response doesn't agree with the way you're behaving. See what I mean? Now, this is called pratipaksha bhavana. This is an ancient exercise. It's pratipaksha bhavana. What it means is, and now I'm just talking on a physical level, this is true on a mental level also. Pratipaksha bhavana means you evoke the bhavana, the emotion, the attitude, which is opposite of the reacting attitude. So, for instance, if I'm feeling angry at someone, the pratipaksha bhavana would be, first of all, and if you bring your knowledge in, you might say to yourself, you know, really, why am I angry at this person? What is it? You know, what is at stake for me to be angry with? Well, because they're doing this and this, I'm not able to, you know, to have it the way that I want it, and so therefore I can't be happy. Mm. And so then you can say, okay, do you really want your behavior to be based on that level, you know, of reality, where I have to have this to be happy, and I have to have this person be a particular way and to be happy? That's a big one. Does this person have to be in a particular way for me to be happy? Does this situation have to be in a particular way for me to be happy? It's a huge thing. It's actually, when we're talking about this anapeksha, now I'll get to that in a moment. What if I say to myself, it seems like that for me now, that's how it is now, but I'm going to act differently. You know? And then you just take one small action. It can be the smallest action, like if there's somebody that you're feeling a lot of disdain for, to take a small step forward and say, hi, how are you? Small step, nothing, small step.
You mean diametrically opposite.
Yeah, the opposite. How you?
Your emotional response.
Yeah, yeah. Like say if you're feeling, that's why they use it mentally. How Swamiji will say it sometimes, it's pretty much shapavanam, mentally, because sometimes you can't bring yourself to do it because you're just not strong enough. You haven't practiced it enough. So you cannot bring yourself to do it. So then you can do it mentally where you visualize your situation with that person. You visualize it. You feel it. And then you say, you know, how would I want to feel? And then you evoke that in yourself. And Swamiji will say, offer a rose. Offer a rose to that person. And then every day, mentally, every day you offer the rose. You can do it physically also. It doesn't have to be a rose. But a rose stands for anything, any offering. You make an offering mentally to that person. Even you can even say, mentally you could say, I'm offering you this rose. I do not want to be angry at you. So please accept this rose. It's a gesture. You can do it mentally. It's amazing if you can do it on a physical level. It's amazing. I've told the story many times. There was one time, I don't know, it was like in 1981, around 1981 for me, where we were running a course up there in Piercy, near Garberville. And there was this one person that, for whatever reasons, it was just a miserable situation. And it just was very hard for me to deal with this person and her jealousy and dislike for me and whatever it was. It's all complex. It's not just one-sided. There's two people involved. It was yucky, horrible.
It's very multifaceted.
Multifaceted. From coming from both sides, always. It's just how it is. It's always too. Even if you don't feel that way. it's her. But however you feel, it's always going to be too. So, I used to talk to Swamiji about this because it was causing me so much distress. You know? And I just could not conquer this thing. And so he said to me several times, you just go up, say one word, just say hi, that's all. Just do that. And I would say, I cannot do that. This is Swamiji, you do it. So I remember, this lady was cooking in the kitchen there, and she was by herself. And I just come out of Swamiji's little room there after having talked to him. This was in Pierce. This wasn't here. It's in Pierce. So I remember standing in the living room looking and saying, can I do that? Maybe this is a serious thing. can I do that? And I was like frozen. Like, no, I can't. And then I said, you just do it. Just do it. And so I got out of this frozen position and I just walked up and said, hi. She turned around and said, hi. And I kept going. But you know what? The spell was broken. Mm-hmm. The spell, it was like a miracle. Mm-hmm. It broke the spell, just that one action. So this is the first time that I'd done something like that, really, in a situation that was of that intensity. But the magic of the spell being broken like that, and the reward of that spell being broken was so much that I started learning, practicing that as a sadhana, not just for her, but if there's anything like that, I would practice. Do that pratipaksha bhavana. And the thing is, this is what my experience was, that I found that the more you do it, the easier it gets to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and the reward is so much because it's so powerful. It breaks the spell, you know. And so with this person, it took me, letting the first time was magical. It worked. It was much easier to do the second time than the third time. And by the fourth time, I'd kind of mastered this pratipakshabhavana, I would say. Mastered it in this sense, that I was no longer afraid to do that because of the reward. You know what I mean? If it didn't have a reward of breaking the spell, then you wouldn't do it. But what happens is that the problem goes away. And so what I'm saying is that if you have any kind of problems like this, well, that's in a very severe one. But even if you have small ones, small little problems, if you just start that practice, that fake it till you make it, and I was faking it, this last thing I wanted to do was go up and say hello. I wanted to go the other way. You know, but I was doing it for a different reason. And the reason was I didn't want to be suffering like this. You know, and so we jokingly say fake it till you make it, but really, you're not really faking it. It is a sadhana, and you're working on yourself, and you're trying to live up to your values and how you want to be, and you don't want to be overwhelmed by the emotional pain that your behavior is causing. Or the way that, it's a mutual, whatever that constellation is causing, you know, you don't want to be owned by it and torn apart by it and emotionally destroyed by it. And emotions can be very, very big, very, very painful. And so this pratipakshabhavana, to me, it's kind of like this golden key. You know, it's a way to kind of unlock that problem. It's a very powerful discipline, which is probably why it's been around for thousands of years, and it even has a name, you know. And so this pratipakshabhavana is also something, so that's, if you can do it on a physical level, you know, just be, if it becomes a habit, habitual, to do that, your mind will quickly change. Quickly changes because you're breaking the pattern. And you can also do it internally. You know, when your mind is hurt or upset about something, you know, you can really be with that and even imagine. You can imagine responding in a different way. To bring in the imagination. To imagine yourself responding in a different way. And that also breaks the pattern because there's many ways you could respond. Your psyche has decided, it has decided, not consciously but almost unconsciously, to respond to the situation in this way because of a myriad of factors that you don't really have any control over. They're all endless, endless cause-effect factors that have caused you to have an emotional response. But that emotional response may not be one that is valued by you. And you might have the tools, you know, to think about trying on another one. And the emotions are very flexible compared to the physical world. And so you can actually, based upon your knowledge and your values, see what it's like to be another way. And that gives your psyche space. It's almost like saying, oh, okay, well, this is one way I could feel, but I could also feel this way. You know? I could feel this way, or I could feel this way. You know, and from the standpoint of my knowledge, from the standpoint of what I know, is it really worth it, you know, to feel this way, in this negative way, when really the nature of your being, the ananda that you're seeking from the world, is really the ananda that you are. So as your knowledge becomes more and more clear, the choice that your buddhi, the choices that it makes are much more in line with your knowledge. And so here, now getting back to this verse, anapekshaha means the one who is not dependent. And really what that means is on an absolute level, really, I am not dependent upon the world to be in a particular way, or for you to be in a particular way, or even for my mind to be in a particular way. That's a big thing, you know. In order, like this, in the way that you are, or the way that the situation is not a cause for my, is not a cause for my happiness. In other words, I'm not dependent on the world for my wholeness. And the reason I'm not dependent on the world for my wholeness is because wholeness or ananda is not something that belongs to the world, it belongs to the self. The self is the source of that. The mind is never away from the self. Okay, so now, there's another level here. So the buddhi recognizes the mind is not away from the self. That's a great thing. When the buddhi recognizes that, then whatever the emotional life is that may be causing problems, the buddhi can actually hold that, you know, and baby it and take care of it and help it, you know. Not asking it to be different so that I can be whole, but asking it to be different to help solve the situation, to help nurture, to take care of the pain, okay? But there's something, there's another layer there too. My ananda, the wholeness of my being, is not dependent on the ananda or the lack of ananda in the mind. That's a very big thing. The ananda of the self, which has been differentiated from the world, is not dependent upon a state of mind. Because you yourself is self-evident. If the whole universe went away, if the minds all went away, there's no mind, say. There's no universe. The ananda of the wholeness, the completeness of your being is there, totally independent. As that viveka becomes clear for you, what your mind is doing, or if it's, you know, acting up or this or that, is not doing anything to you. Now, what I mean by that, this is something also that's often, I think, can be misunderstood. When I say it doesn't do anything to you, you can think like this. All right, the mind is really acting up, and of course I understand intellectually, and I know that my being, my fullness, my wholeness is not being touched in any way. But then the next sentence will be, even though I'm not experiencing it. And the example for that is this, the mistaken use of this example. If there's the sun is illuminating a cloudy sky, a cloudy, dark, rainy sky, the one who's standing, right, on the ground, looking up at the sun, knows that the sun is there because the sun is illumining the clouds, right? So you know the sun is there, but you can't really experience it because all you can experience is the clouds. True? If I'm sitting on the ground with my eyes, I'm looking at the dark clouds, I'm only experiencing the clouds. And I know that the sun is there, I can infer it's there because it's light and because of the sun I see the clouds. And so then that's what a person will think, that when my mind is cloudy and dark and upset, I know I'm there, but I'm overwhelmed by the darkness of my mind. And so myself is not being experienced. I know that I'm the one lighting up the mind, but I'm being covered. Right? I'm being covered. That's what we can think. But that isn't true. Because I am the sun. The sun is not covered by the clouds. See that? The sun isn't covered by the clouds. The sun illumines the clouds. I'm the sun. And so the sun, as it is, the self-effulgent sun, is there, its own experience as is, and the clouds are there. Okay? Now the clouds go away, and the sky is there. Now, what has happened to the sun, the sun's experience of the sun, in the presence or absence of the clouds? Absolutely nothing. So to think that your ananda, the ananda of your being, the me, is in any way affected or changed by the clouds, or by the dark mind, the hurt mind, you know, the depressed mind, is not true. If that viveka is there, you're as much there in the cloudy mind as you are in the sunny mind, I mean, in the clear mind. And that's the viveka that allows you to allow the world to be. Now, it's also an allow the mind to be, because you're still there in exactly the same way. Now, on another level, the cloudy mind tends to not be there anymore. Because the reason for the clouds was the ajnanam, the ignorance, that caused me to behave in the world in such a way that created a lot of clouds. A lot of hurt, a lot of darkness, a lot of emotions. So the mind does lose, you know, that reactivity. And it does have much more shanti. But from the standpoint of you, the shanti and the lack of shanti is making shanti or lack of shanti in you, who are the sun, who are always exactly the same. That is moksha. Moksha is the recognition that the self is liberated, that you are liberated, that you are always the same, that you are whole and complete, like you are the one that you seek. And that one is not subject to any type of modification or change, nor does it require the mind to illumine it. So what we're really doing with gaining knowledge is we're removing the ignorance that causes the superimposition for my mind to take itself to be me and the self to have the qualities of the mind. That the knowledge is taking away that so that yourself as you are is recognized and you are always you. Right? You're always you. You've removed the ignorance that has caused it to be superimposed on the mind or body or sense organs. So this anapekshaha, this independence, this freedom, it is an absolute independence because the self is absolutely free. Right? It's not dependent, your being is not dependent on anything. So that's the ultimate level of independence, is the self-shining nature of you, which is not subject to any change. The second level of independence from the standpoint of the mind is the recognition of the mind that the ananda that it has sought is the very nature of the self, which is its very being. And so the mind need do nothing at all to achieve ananda, to gain ananda. It is its very self. And so whatever the world is doing, I can face that objectively because it doesn't really contribute to my ananda. That's the second level of this anapeksha. You see that? Of this independence. So now, that's one quality, that anapeksha. Suchihi. Suchihi means purity. Purity means on a physical level, you keeping your environment clean, keeping your body clean. Suchihi on a mental level, you know, on a mental, emotional level, is that freedom, the space that we give others, the space that we give others to be. This is where Swamiji brought in that. Now I remember the Pratipaksha Bhavana. To keep your mind, to keep everyone outside, you know, to give others the space to be who they are, without having them enter into you where you have to want them to be different and all of this. So being really, another way is to keep Ishvara as Ishvara. Give everybody the same space that Ishvara gives. Ishvara gives all of us space. Swamiji said that once. For a jnani, your heart has to be as big as Ishvara. And because you give everybody the space to be, to exist, and they're not a threat to you, it's that abhayam comes in. You can give people space to be who they are if you don't need them to be different. And then if you do need them to be different, you can have a little mantra. You know, let this person be. If you can help, help. But let them be. That becomes such a gift. Mm-hmm. Somebody's talked about it. I see it as such a gift, you know, to let a person be as they are, and if you can help, help. It's a different type of buddhi. I mean, I learned that so much from Swamiji. I've told you this example that he would use, like, for his students. I mean, he doesn't do this with everybody because not everybody wants it. But for his students, how does he see you? He would see you more as say if you took a block of stone or clay and you just chip away the things that, you know, don't belong there. Just chip the things away that don't belong there. You help with that. Because you see the person. You see the person minus the pain and the problems that the ajnanam has caused. And so you chip away at those things, you know, to help the person be free. But you're seeing the person, you know, and you're removing the obstructions, you know. That's a beautiful gift. Because in order to do that, you have to see the person, right? You can't chip away things that don't belong without seeing the person. And so that's that suchihi. That pratipaksha bhavana is a beautiful exercise, sadhana to do in terms of giving people their space internally. If you're not giving people space internally, then there's some emotional reaction in there, and then you can work on that pratipaksha bhavana. And bring your knowledge in. Like, why do you really feel that way? This is another little thing. When you bring your knowledge in like that, like, why are you really feeling that way toward that person? If you ask yourself that, you also have to be a psychologist. You have to take care of the little ones inside also. And then you say, why are you really feeling that way? The little girl or boy can say, well, you know. And then you say, is that how your mother used to treat you? Is that how your father, is that how your brother treated you? What's really going on there? And let the little ones, you know, have their say. You know? But then you can also take it deeper in that than that. After you take care of the little ones, you can just say to yourself, you know, give everybody their space. You can have a little mantra. Just give people their space. Let them be, you know. But then if you say something like that, it's, you know what you're talking about. You know, because you have some knowledge behind it. You have these little mantras, you know, that are packed with knowledge. It's just like, give people their space, or let your heart needs to be as big as Ishwara, because Ishwara has given all of us the space. He doesn't complain, you know. Bhagavan doesn't complain. We all have our space. We all have our prarabdha. You know, there's room for all of us, right? There's room for all of us. So then in our heart we have to let there be room for all of us. Give space inside. So that's the shuchihi. Dakshaha. Ooh, okay. Dakshaha is this capacity to, Swamiji will say, daksha has lots of different meanings. So daksha is means to be, have capacity to be capable. So thing. But here, dakshaha means to, they have the capacity to be objective. It's all along these same lines. The capacity to be objective, to not run let your emotions run your behavior, but to act in the world in a way that is appropriate. What is being asked of me to do in this? What is being asked of me in this particular situation? Not so much based on my raga dvesha, but just based upon dharma. Daksha. Udasinaha means, again, to be able to be a person who is not taking sides. This is an interesting, even in terms of your own, in any type of a dispute or in a disagreement, there's always two sides, you know. And usually, on both each side, each person has a point. There's truth to be found on both sides. So can you stay in the middle, in a sense, you know, in terms of your reactive capacity? Can you, are you able to stay in the middle, you know, and objectively see this person's position and that person's position? So Udasana is the one who, like a mediator, you know. Sometimes an Udasana is called a mediator. You know, somebody who can objectively understand both sides, and then understanding both sides come to a solution rather than taking sides. And so think of that in terms of you in your relationship with others. Can you see both sides? In any given situation or with any person, are you able to see both sides? Or are you only able to see your side? So Udasana means the one who can hold both sides and then take an action. Holding both sides, then take an action. So Udasana is the one who's able to be in the middle. Gatavyataha is the one who is abhayam, one who is free from fear. The vyata, the fear, the anxiety is gata, it is gone. The fear and the anxiety that's caused by jnanam, by self-ignorance, gata, that has gone. Because basically, there is no way to harm the self. Two things. There is no way to harm the self. And in terms of the mitya, the creation that you experience, there is no way for things not to change. There's no way for there not to be birth or death. There's no way for things not to change. So the only thing here that is free of death, really, free of change, is the self. And so it's that knowledge, this is a big knowledge to have in a real way, you know, that knowledge plus the recognition of your life being Ishwara. What that means is that the life that you have, it's not your creation. It's part and parcel of Ishwara. You have your prarabdha. Each one of us has our prarabdha. And what it kind of amounts to, what is yours you will get, and what is not yours you won't. And we can kick and scream, you know, and we can very much influence the situation by our temper, you know, by the temper with which we bring to the situation. In that way we can make the situation better or worse, which is a very powerful thing, actually. The temper that we bring to the situation affects it, positively and negatively. You know, so we can do that. We can kick and scream, or we can imagine, you know, and fantasize, if I would have done that, and would have done that, and when is this going to happen, is this ever going to change? You know, all of these imaginations, you know, are muddying the water, so to speak. But actually, your life is unfolding as Ishwara.
Could you define your use of temper?
Temper means like the attitude, the emotional temper, the temperament. So that, you know, you do influence. It's like you put an emotional maya, a magic, actually, over any given situation by the temper you bring to it. You know, the attitude that you bring to it, the emotional, your emotions. Your emotions affect your environment very much. You know, they don't really change the physical environment, but they do put a frown on people's face. Concern or worry or, you know, or they put a smile on people's face. But people don't realize, I mean, I don't either, I mean, more and more, but the more conscious you become, the more you realize that actually you matter in the room, that you are actually in the room, and you actually matter. that your smile or your frown or your anger, you know, that's your contribution to the room. It's very interesting, like if we talk about in classes, like when I teach at CIS, the mix of students, which the mix of people includes the teacher. It's kind of the mix of people, the mix of temperaments, creates the space.
Mm-hmm.
And that mix is made of every single person in the room. But most people in the room don't realize that they are also in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And that they exist, you know, that they exist in the room, and that their smile or their frown or their way that they are is something that is adding to the ambiance of the room. It's an amazing, amazing thing, you know. So we do add that. That's the jiva's overlay. That's our overlay, in a sense, on the jiva srishti, you know, as the emotional color we put onto our situation. But what if more and more we realize that, you know, I will get what's mine, and I won't get what's not. And this is my life. This is the life. You know? And there's nothing to be afraid of that life. You know, there's nothing to be afraid, really. Nothing happens to me any more than waking up from a dream into the waking state, how you realize nothing happens to you because nothing does happen to you. And this is continually changing, you know. And my life is my life, my illness is my illness, my death is my death. You know, we're all going to have our own unique death, and your death will be your death. You know? And that's true for all living beings. You'll have your own unique death, and you can fear that, but if you really think about it, that is a total waste of time to fear it, because it's inevitable. So if you take it as Ishwara, you know, your life will be your life and your death will be your death, and the flow of things that are given to you, that unfold through your life. So always much easier to see your life in hindsight than going forward. But once you can see it going forward in the same way that you can see it in hindsight, kind of an unfolding pattern, you know, you can anticipate it with kind of with interest and wonder, instead of that jivatvam, without that jivatvam overlay. So that's the gata vyataha. It's a freedom of fear that's brought, the freedom of fear that's brought about through knowledge. And sarva arambha parityagi, that's the one who is parityagi, completely given up all beginnings. Means all karma. The only one that can give up all karma is the jnani, who realizes that I am free of all karma. On another level, it's realizing, letting all of these beginnings take place without the kartritvam on my part. Because beginnings are, from the standpoint of samsara, of the world, not samsara, but of Ishwara, of the world, beginnings for you are continually taking place. The problem comes when you think that I must have this beginning and not this one. Yeah. That's where the problem comes. If you can, that doesn't mean because we're talking about a jnani now. Jnani doesn't really, a jnani takes the beginnings that are given. Right? You take the beginnings that are given. You're not yourself trying to create your life. There's no reason to. You can try to create your life if you want to, but it's already been created. So you're always after the fact. Every moment of trying to create your life, the life is already there created. So really all you're doing, if you really think about it, is you're responding. You're responding to the opportunities that have been presented. And so if you take it, it's much different psychologically. If you take your life as responding to the life, you know, then you're in the present. You're always in the present. You know? And you're responding, that's an action. Right? But you're responding to something rather than trying to create something that's not there. It's a different psychology. The one understands, you know, and we're looking at more as responding, that Ishwara is bringing up, the whole thing is an unfoldment of Ishwara, rather than the jiva having to work its way through an inert creation, carving out your life. You know, if you look at yourself as responsible for all the beginnings, beginnings means every karma has a beginning. So what if you give up those beginnings and are just responding to the life that is there? There's still all kinds of beginnings. It's nothing but beginnings. It's endless beginnings. But the attitude toward it is different. You can only have that attitude, though, from with knowledge. Otherwise, you can have a karma yoga buddhi. I do my actions and I take everything as prasad from Ishwara. That's the karma yoga buddhi. But what about when I recognize I actually don't do anything? The self doesn't do anything at all, ever. You know? And the life is unfolding. My life is unfolding. Whose life is unfolding? It's Ishwara. So all this prarabdha karma is Ishwara. You know? It's Ishwara from the standpoint of this jiva. Right? That's prarabdha karma is Ishwara from the standpoint of this jiva. You see that? And that means the prarabdha karma also includes your whole situation. The prarabdha isn't just centered on this jiva, it's centered on the world that the jiva finds itself in. That's the prarabdha karma. It's not isolated. It's not like just, this is the prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma is walking through this world that's not your prarabdha karma. It's your whole experience is interconnected with time and space and others. They're all part, everybody's part of your prarabdha. Every situation is part of the prarabdha.
So yeah. We all deserve each other.
Totally. Thank you, Bhagavan, for giving me you. So then, one more thing, let's finish this. Yaha, again he says, Yaha mad bhaktaha same priyaha. This also, you can take this. You can take this as a sadhana for a mumukshu, but if you take it as a jnani, there's something really nice. I didn't say this last time. It says the one who is all of these things, anapekshaha, suchihi, dakshaha, is that one who is my devotee, and he is beloved. That one is beloved to me. He's beloved to me. So that's Krishna talking. Now another thing to understand about this, for a person who is mature in their knowledge, their body, mind, sense organs, how they behave, is in a sense a mirror to the self. It's the behavior of one who has jnana nishtha, and where the emotional things have, you know, been matured. That the behavior of the self, if it was behaving. Right? It is the thinking of the self, if it was thinking, and the emotions of the self, if it was emoting. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's why a jnani is beloved. Because the jnani is always so beloved, because when you're in the presence of somebody who is mature in their knowledge like that, you know, you're with yourself. The feeling is that person knows me better than I know myself, or loves me more than I love myself, you know, or accepts me more than I accept myself. All of it is true, because in fact, the self, your being, is the most accommodating, the most generous, the most without duality, I mean, just your very swarupa, is so whole and so full and so complete, you know, that it is the beloved. There's nothing that you can love more than that. That one that is just total wholeness or total love. And so, when Krishna says, that one, you know, that one is my devotee, that one is most beloved to me, even internally or externally, you know, even with upadhi, what I'm saying is that love is evoked. What is evoked is the love of the self. For jnani, as you mature, your mind and your sense organs and your body and your behavior is in harmony with the self, rather than being in harmony with ajnanam. Right? It's true. Your mind doesn't behave in a way that's not natural to you, to the self. And so everybody then will love you because your behavior is something which evokes love. Your behavior is an expression of the self. The self is the most beloved. So internally, the self is the most beloved. And any time any being is behaving in a way that is expressive of the self, that being is beloved. Which is maybe why animals are so loved. Maybe that's why we love our animals so much.
Purity? Yeah.
Purity. You know, they don't have so much jiva srishti.
Mm.
You know, to block that natural purity. Yeah. Anyway, that's what I think about animals. Anyway, I think that's enough for tonight. Stop. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Hi to you. Hi, Jagadish. Welcome.
Radha?
Yeah.
I have. They're kind of, maybe it's one question, but maybe it's a bunch of jumbled together questions.
Yeah.
But it seems like there are, you know, like you were talking about the balance and being the mediator, and then just throughout the whole thing, there are some situations where it's like 50-50. But there are some situations that, you know, one side is more, it's not really balanced.
Yeah, that's true. But the thing is, can you objectively see both sides? That's all. It's not that you, when you're trying to come to a solution, it's not like the solution is always right down the middle. But from your standpoint, are you able to see from both perspectives? It's a, in a way, it's a kind of empathy. Can you see the other person's position? I mean, really see the other person's position. And you make an attempt to understand both positions. I think that's all it is. You know? And when we say not taking sides, you know, one solution, the solution that might not be equal which way you go, but you're not taking sides in terms of emotionally. You're objectively trying to see each standpoint.
You know, sometimes trying to see the other position, you conclude that it's just too horrific. You know?
That's not quite the Udasana.
Huh? But
because, no, what I mean... what I mean there... When... It's not that there aren't horrific things, you know. That isn't the point. It's seeing the other person's standpoint. There's understanding the other, trying to understand where that other person is coming from. You know, that's what often we don't do. We just dismiss the horrific standpoint without understanding. You know, really understanding where the person is coming from and why they're feeling that way, why they're thinking that way. From their point of view, it's not a horrific standpoint. So.
Along those lines, doing the Pratipaksha Bhavana,
yeah.
I have some people in my life who I don't want to do that with. I've done practices that, Buddhist practices that are analogous in the past. But
I mean,
there's people who I'm actually afraid they're going to hurt me physically. and I think it's real.
But you might not do pratipaksha-bhavana on a physical level then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and I think there's part of me that doesn't even want to engage mentally, but I kind of have to.
See, that's the trick. If you don't have to engage mentally, that means that those people aren't inside of you causing any problems. Then you don't have to.
Well, they are inside of me causing problems. Exactly. They're outside of me causing problems.
Exactly. And so then they're inside of you causing problems. So then how do you... I asked Swamiji once in that those type of situations, how do you handle that? You know, when there's a person who is causing a lot of problems... You know, and certainly does not wish you well. How do you handle that? I was asking him personally, how do you handle that when there's a person like that in your life? Because he gets that too, you know, transference and all of that can be really some very difficult kind of situations can come up, you know. And it's such also that when somebody is really not wishing you well, that you can in an objective way feel it. You can feel their energy. Maybe that sounds maybe woo-woo, but it's not woo-woo. It's like in a room, if you can feel other people's energy, you respond to their energy.
Yeah, communication.
Yeah, it's there. It's a subtle communication. So I said, what do you do when that type of evil eye, in India they call it the evil eye, you know, what do you do when that's being coming at you? And he said what he does is he just receives it and says, I wish you well, and sends it back. You know, it's like
he sends the I wish you well back, not the
yeah.
Evil.
No, he says, yeah, you got like, when a knife's coming at you, you can't do it.
It's martial arts.
Save
the energy.
You know, it's kind of like that, you know. I'm sorry for your suffering. I wish you well. You know. Have you ever heard? I can never pronounce this. It's Honoponomia or something. You know that Hawaiian?
Oh yeah.
You know how to pronounce that?
I don't remember.
I can use it. Honoponopono.
Oh, that one. It's really long.
Yeah.
Yes. Is it a phrase? What is it?
Yeah. No, it's a Hawaiian teaching that's very interesting, actually. What it is, actually, I passed this out to my spiritual counseling students at CIF. They brought in this Hawaiian kind of wise shaman, like a Hawaiian shaman type of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
They brought him into a prison where to help in a prison environment where there was just a lot of violence and unrest in that particular prison, and they were not able to get a handle on it. The guards, everybody was having a real problem. And so they brought this Hawaiian teacher to that
kahuna,
whatever, to the prison, and he stayed in a room outside, a little apartment right outside the prison. And I guess they brought in the charts of all of the inmates and people, and he just stayed in this room. And apparently what he did was something like this.
The charts, you said?
Huh? Yeah, the charts on the patients. Not astrology. Yeah. They brought his records.
Time served.
And so he just spent time thinking about each patient. Each inmate, you know? And saying something like, I'm so apologizing, you know, for whatever has happened to their life, and I'm so sorry for your suffering, or I'm so sorry for what's been done to you, or something like that. He did this for each one of them, and over a very short period of time, everything started to change, you know, the whole system started to change. I can print this thing out for you. I've got it. If you want it, I'll give it to you.
Yeah,
but I believe in that kind of thing because I find it to be true. Is, you know, that, and that to me is why prayer works also. Mm-hmm. You know, that that how you hold a person, and if a person's very, very hurt or very anger, very bitter for all the ways that they've been hurt in life, if somebody comes and cares and say, I'm so sorry for what has happened, you know, that person all of a sudden is being seen, even if it's on a subtle level.
It's very rare to hear that remark.
Mm-hmm. But this wasn't even being said. I don't know if these things, this is true, the story is true, but I mean, it is something, it is a practice in Hawaii. And I think it has merit, because I do feel that how we hold each other, it does help, you know? And I think I think negative, you know, it's harmful also.
Seems like a deep, it's kind of culmination out of giving validation and compassion. Like,
yes, validation and compassion. I'm sorry for what's happened to you, that you've been hurt so badly, you know? And apologize, I'm so sorry. I think he apologized personally, I don't remember exactly. I'm so sorry for whatever I've done to hurt you. I'll have to look it up and see.
So I have another aspect to this question. So at the beginning, you're talking about not being dependent on situations.
For your ananda, yeah.
For your ananda.
Right.
And it's also, it seems to be the case that our environment, internally and externally, does affect us in ways so that we could be more or less predisposed or have the causes and conditions that would enable us to make the viveka versus being in a situation where it might be much more difficult.
That's right. That's why they actually say that for a person to be a mumukshu, they consider it to be Ishwara Anugraha, the grace of God. And then they actually say crores and crores of punya, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, to even get to a place where that mumukshutvam is there. It's considered a huge, tremendous punya. And punya means you've worked for it, you know, lifetime after lifetime.
But a lot of times to that person it seems like a burden, you know, rather than...
Well, the thing is, look, if you look at it like this, you become a mumukshu. Everybody becomes a mumukshu at different stages of their own emotional development. Like, for instance, you could become... That mumukshutvam could come when you've already worked through so many things in the world that your behavior now is basically very kind of dharmic. You know, you've come to that point when you meet your teacher. But another mumukshu could come to meeting their teacher at a point where they still have a lot of emotional things to work out. It's just their mumukshutvam arose in this particular situation, and yours arose in this situation. And so you would have seemingly less to work out
like Ramana.
Almost less to work out, because your mumukshutvam came to you at a time after you worked through all of these different things, you know? Sometimes I think of it like this, like, because I've had a lot of students have once said to me, oh, I'm so old, I wish I would have gotten this knowledge when I was 20. Now I'm in my 60s, you know, and now I only have like 20 years to live or something, and I come to this knowledge so late in life. I really wish I would have got it when I was young, you know. But if that person doesn't work through their raga dvesha's and whatnot and their clarity, and then they die, and then they'll take a birth, and then when they're 15 or 20, they'll take up the mumukshutvam where they left off. And so then the other people will say, oh, you came to this knowledge so early, you're so young.
Yeah, but I blew it last time.
Then blow it, though. See, it's not blowing it, because from the standpoint of the jiva, the lifetime isn't just this lifetime. The lifetime is... on many, many lifetimes. And so at some point along the way, that mumukshutvam comes. And then now that it's come, now there's all this development that takes place. Well, say it came at the end of your life, And you didn't have, that's what Arjuna was so afraid of. He said to Krishna, you know, I might get killed on the battlefield, and I don't, what will happen to me? You know, because I still have a lot of growing to do. You've given me all this teaching, but I have to own it. What will happen if I get killed? And he said, don't worry. What will happen is, you, depending upon your karmas, you'll either be born into a house of yogis, you know, because you don't have anything left, karmas that, you know, inside that you want to work out. You'll be born into a house of yogis and pick up this knowledge very young. Or you'll be born into a very dharmic family, and then you'll work out the things that you have to work out, and then you'll pick up this knowledge. So it's not going to stop. It's just one, this is one day in the life of.
You know. Well, can you really see your karma as Ishvara's play projection, rather than you creating it?
Yeah.
I mean,
That's why this understanding Ishvara is so important. Because the jiva really surrenders to Ishvara, not to Brahman. It's recognizing this body, mind, sense organs, all of this is Ishvara, you know. And then it's a very interesting situation to be in, because here you are as a jiva, but you're really part and parcel of Ishvara.
Yeah, but right? It always seems like I'm making that life rather than it being part of the part of the whole.
And that's why Nididhyasana is so important. One of the things for Nididhyasana is what we call the releasing you from this Dehatma Buddhi, the conviction that the self is the body. Right? Because once you, and that's also the recognition of Ishvara, that Nididhyasana. So you can do Nididhyasana, you can do meditations bringing Ishvara. You know, hand this body, mind, sense organs over to Ishvara. Hand the life over to Ishvara, and then visualize your life as part of Ishvara. You can do contemplation, you know. So when even though we talk so much and teach so much about Ishvara, sometimes you just have to sit in the reality of that in meditation. That can help.
You just don't get there just purely intellectually. I mean, mentally. You know, I want to ask this question before the session is over. You said, you know, when we were talking about the mumukshu, you were saying that the Buddhi owns the knowledge, but the manas doesn't.
Yeah.
And I'd like to understand that more. What's this?
No, I don't say that it doesn't. I say, it's not like that. It will.
Or not yet. Or
there's an emotional lag time.
Emotionally, yeah. So could you expand a little bit on that? That would become interesting, just to kind of grasp the progression there in that evolution.
Well, I think you can see examples of it yourself, where you just look at your own life. Like, you know, you have knowledge, but you're not acting like you do.
Right. Yeah, I'm always amazed about that, actually.
Yeah, okay, that's all I mean. Uh-huh. You have knowledge, but you're not acting like you do. And it's because there's emotional commitment. You know, it takes a while for your knowledge to burn through all of the ajnanam, all of the commitments, all of the response, all of the raga dvesha.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a while, your knowledge is in a way competing with your raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes. And because your likes and dislikes are, you have commitment to them, not to all of them. Some, it doesn't make any difference at all. But then whether you have knowledge or not, it doesn't make any difference at all. It's the ones that do make a difference. Those are serious, you know. And so how to be released from those, that's the whole karma yoga, you know, is to, those ones that are so serious, you do what you can to fulfill them, and then you accept the results as, with that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi as prasad from Bhagavan. Until this sensation that my ananda is dependent upon the fulfillment of my desires, that slowly just goes away. What you'll find, how it goes away, is you'll find more and more that your desires, the desires are not worth it. The commitment to desires are not worth it.
You know what's so interesting about that process? Yeah, that makes so total sense. And what's so interesting is there's a part that recognizes the understanding, and there's also a part that recognizes you can make a change, right? I mean, you can make a change. You can say, okay, I'm changing my diet. Okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you can't push the river. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like you kind of, in a way, one foot you have in your prarabdha karma.
Yeah.
The other one is already kind of stepping out of that. Because you know that there's also a possibility that you, with your consciousness of evolution of your own, you know, of your own understanding, you can actually also, you're co-creating. You're not just a victim of your own prarabdha karma, or a slave, let's say, of your prarabdha karma.
Well,
you're actually co-creating with your prarabdha karma.
There's free will and prarabdha karma that are together. They're intertwined together. That's right.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, in a certain way, you can only move so much. You know?
Absolutely. You have free will within your prarabdha karma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
not outside of it.
And that's kind of, in a way, that brings definitely up a certain, I feel like I get impatient there a little bit with my, like what you were saying, you know, you have the understanding, but your manas is not quite there. So it's kind of requires time, right? And maturation.
It requires, like Swamiji will use the example, you know, you give a little child a beautiful little rosebud, and it thinks, I want to see what the bud is like when it's opened.
Yeah.
And so it tries to pull the poor little bud open. And it doesn't work that way. You know,
but at least it knows what's in it.
Yeah, it's kind of in a crippled little way, poor little thing. You know, but there's a natural, it does take, patience is a wonderful thing. Just think about it, you know, with your little girl, you know, Mira. You don't want to rush her growing up.
Yeah.
You know, you want to watch, to give her the environment
mm-hmm.
where she can beautifully grow up. And that's how we have to be with ourselves, too. You know, as a mumukshu, you know, as a person who wants to really mature in this knowledge, you have to provide an environment to let that happen, and then and then be patient, and you know, working with it.
Yeah, she's a good teacher.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay, should we stop? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.